Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
As the echoes of student activists and their March for Our Lives this past weekend continue, an argument on why gun control policies may not work as intended. Leah Libresco is a data journalist and statistics expert. She wrote a piece for The Washington Post about this, and she joins us today from New York City. And Leah, welcome to the show. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me on.
We'll get to the numbers in a minute. I'm curious about how you're seeing this activism and the nature of it that has emerged after the Parkland, Florida shootings, and whether you have some skepticism about what they want, their end goals.
Well, I think there's something that is very heartening about the students' interest in making political change and their willingness and organization for mobilization. I disagree with some of the things that they're proposing, or at least in the impact they'll have. But to be honest, it reminds me a bit of breast cancer activism, where you both have women mobilizing for desperately needed changes initially. Initial breast cancer surgeries were too invasive and didn't include women in part of the decision making. Now, still, out of a desire to do anything to prevent breast cancer, you'll see people mobilizing to offer mammograms to people who really shouldn't be having them. So I think there's sometimes a desire to do something that can lead us astray. But I do think it's always a good idea to kind of get engaged and try and find solutions.
That's a really interesting analogy that I hadn't thought of. What you're saying is, do we always have the evidence that the advocacy is the answer, right? Not the
exactly.
Not the activism itself, but what you're advocating for.
Exactly. And I think this is something that everyone who's interested in gun control for the sake of saving lives has to be really interested in, because it's just not a reliable signal how pissed off gun owners are when you propose it.
You say that after you and a team of researchers investigated gun deaths in America and gun policies in other countries, you had this, I think, a pretty surprising conclusion, and it was surprising to you. You went into this research believing what?
Well, I went in believing that I kind of already knew a lot about guns. You know, I knew assault rifles were bad. I knew that silencers were, you know, bad and for crimes. And I'd kind of picked this up from the way many politicians talk about it when they're stoking up their base. You know, right after the Las Vegas shooting, several prominent politicians called for a ban on silencers when they weren't even used in the crime. So part of my education was just digging into what guns are and seeing that even some of the language I'd used when asking questions about policy was wrong. And I'd really use assault weapons as my primary example there, because, you know, I knew that there'd been an assault weapons ban. I knew that people were calling for it again. I never really paused to go, what is an assault weapon? And as defined by the previous law, it's a weird category. It's not a natural category. It's not how guns are marketed. It's not a definite category of guns. It's, you know, a semi-auto gun that has too many features attached to it at the point of sale.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a gun and it, you know, maybe can have a bayonet and a folding stock, but not also, you know, one more thing. You have a list of items and you can't have too many attached at point of sale. And even that I might have thought reasonable until I talked to more people who actually know guns. And I had someone explain to me that, you know, these guns are popular because they're modular. They're like Lego bricks. So you can buy them with whatever you want attached, or as few things as you want attached at point of sale. And you take them home and it's legal to buy any of the components and just snap them on. They're meant to be changeable, switchable. And that made me think that the assault weapons ban isn't really targeted at something real.
You know, I was thinking about your argument with bump stocks, too. As you know, mm-hmm. that was the everybody was saying, well, that's the thing that we have to go after next. I think it was also after the Las Vegas shooting.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't happened. And in pursuing it, always seems like, and maybe this is just human nature and this is natural, but that the argument about what the next legislation, the next problem that has to be solved is behind the curve, right? We're naturally
Absolutely.
Always looking backwards.
Well, and I think that's a big mistake because we look at unrepresentative examples of shootings and try and use that as our national policy guide. Bump stocks were, you know, this was like the one shooting where they'd be really useful. Gun owners mostly don't use bump stocks for targeted shooting because they're terrible.
Right.
They inhibit your aim. You know, you'd never take them hunting. They're for going to the range and just feeling really cool because you fire a lot of bullets all at once. Now, the Las Vegas shooter did find a circumstance where because of his positioning and because of how many people were there, accuracy just didn't matter to him. But it's very few shootings that follow that model and very few gun owners that are even interested in owning a bump stock. So when we're chasing that as our kind of let's have a big impact, we're missing chances to have a much larger impact on gun deaths by focusing on something like even enforcing existing law. One of my colleagues at 538, Haley, was looking at domestic violence victims, where there are states that, you know, require that once there is a restraining order against you for domestic violence, you have to give up your guns. And so it sounds like mission accomplished, the law exists. But they don't follow up. You know, they have a backlog. They don't work through it. And a lot of abusers keep their guns even after they've been legally prohibited from doing it because the police don't have time or don't prioritize making sure they've handed them over. Now, that's a lot less exciting than bump stocks,
right?
But it matters more.
I think you're putting your finger in, as you did in this piece, on something that's frustrating, which is the day-to-day gun deaths, right, that happen through suicide or, as you've just, these domestic violence incidents. That's the kind of thing that every now and then we look at the statistics and we're shocked. But it does not get the kind of coverage and, you know, horrified interest, of course, that these mass shootings, as terrible as they are, that's what gets the media coverage and restarts the conversation, not the day-to-day stuff that's going on with guns.
And I'll say this is one thing I appreciated in the March for Our Lives that I saw in who was speaking and what they spoke about, that the Parkland students did do a good job of bringing forward speakers who were talking not only about mass shootings at times, but I have several African-American speakers who talked about homicide rates in their own communities and how little attention is paid to them by the media and how much attention is paid to school shooting. And if we want to talk about gun deaths, as you're saying, the numbers are that 2/3 of the gun deaths, and it's about 33,000 a year in the U.S., are suicide. And the next biggest and relevant categories are domestic violence, and a bit larger than that, about 1 in 5 deaths are young men killing other young men, often in street violence.
Mm-hmm.
And targeting that and protecting those people usually isn't just about making it hard for them to get guns.
Right.
In many cases, they're people who are already prohibited from owning guns. It's often about longer, patient, expensive, important work, like the ceasefire program, where they find former gang members who help them track conflicts so that you know once someone's been shot, well, here are the 3 people who were good friends with him who may feel like they're duty-bound to, you know, take care of their friend by shooting someone else. And here are the pastors and community members we're going to go send to talk to them tonight. It matters more. And it's just not something we can do with a stroke of the pen or a signing of a law. It's something that has to be funded and staffed day after day, year after year, but it makes a real difference.
Leah Labresco is with us. If you've just tuned into the show, she's a data journalist and a statistics expert, and she wrote a piece about gun deaths, the availability of guns, and what she learned in really digging into the research. She wrote it for the Washington Post, and she's with us today to talk about it. Leah, I don't want anybody to hear this and or just tune in and think that you're saying, no, the mass shootings in the school aren't the real problem. The real problem is the day-to-day. It all, what we want to do is apply evidence to all of it. That's what you're
Absolutely.
Advocating here.
And there, each one is a real problem and a real tragedy. You know, that's why there's the expression, you know, he who saves one person, it's as if he'd saved the entire world. But what I care about is where do we know the most to intervene?
Right.
Because, you know, each person's life is worth saving, but we sometimes just don't know enough to prevent certain kinds of deaths. And if you'll permit one more public health metaphor, because that's my primary mode of nerdery, you know, grouping mass shootings is itself weird. It's a little bit like the way that when we talk about the war on cancer, we just make a big pile of all the cancers we've made no progress against and say, we're looking for a way to beat cancer. Well, what we did is we made a list of everything we have the most trouble addressing, and we kind of hope and expect there will be a silver bullet that knocks them all off. But the only thing they have in common, besides that they're cancer, are that they're cancers that haven't been receptive to any of the modes of treatment or exploration we've come up with.
Right.
Mass shootings are a bit like that. They're weird. They're unlike each other. And the things that they have that are like each other aren't specific enough to be the focus of an intervention, right? Almost all mass shootings are carried out by men.
Mm.
That's great. I know that. There are a lot of men, and it doesn't help me narrow it down.
Well, I want to come back to this idea about guns and suicide, because I had Robert Spitzer on the show recently. You're probably familiar with him. He wrote Guns mm-hmm. Across America. And he does a lot of this statistical research into gun policy that you've been doing as well. And here's what he told me about guns and suicide.
Over 30,000 people are killed each year through gun violence, and that includes murders, suicides, and fatal gun accidents. And indeed, there are roughly twice as many gun suicides each year as there are gun homicides. So in many ways, the gun suicide problem is even a bigger problem than gun homicide, although obviously it's all a problem, and it all certainly needs to be addressed by our lawmakers and government officials.
You know, I was thinking about that in the moment when we're having that discussion, and then knowing that I was going to talk to you. I wonder if we don't hear a lot of legislative discussion about guns and suicide, because to some degree, we believe that that's a personal mental health problem that, you know, state legislatures shouldn't get in the middle of.
Well, I think
here's
the advocacy group that's kind of doing the most to explore what you can do to prevent these suicides, and has kind of the biggest group behind it, because with a gun homicide, you have the victims who are coming forward, or the friends of the victims, but there's not always as big a group who stands up for the victims of suicide, especially as most of these suicides are older men in the U.S. who may already be alone and not have someone who speaks up for them after they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
But the group that does speak up are former service members,
right?
Because the military has an enormous problem with suicide, and you know, to its credit, has kept trying to figure out what can be done and has fallen short of a real solution through often a mix of kind of, you know, the bureaucracy of the military, you know, sometimes puts in effort, sometimes doesn't. But individual service members have put in a tremendous amount of effort to save the lives of people whose lives they were defending when they were in combat. And they come back home and they find that suddenly they don't know how to keep their brothers and sisters safe. So I think there's been a lot of innovation in terms of how do we help people avoid suicide when we already know they're at risk. But there really hasn't been something that's enough of a solution that I can point to say, well, this is what we should implement. But I think the military kind of and the service members have the right idea, which is experiment more,
yeah.
Try different things. You know, and we're years away from really taking a huge change to that suicide rate. But, you know, it's going to be by experimenting and following up and keeping data that we get an idea. One of the ideas I've heard after this most recent mass shooting, which wasn't as related to mass shootings, but that I'm personally really interested in, you know, seeing tried and seeing what the data turns out to be, was the idea that you could get almost a restraining order on someone's guns for mental health or suicidality or threat reasons, where, you know, you file some kind of report and then they have a hearing where they can defend their right to have their guns. And if, you know, they keep their guns in the meantime, unless you file kind of a higher level of scrutiny
right.
report.
Right.
And I was really moved by that just because I have a friend who's kind of had experiences with suicidality and owns guns. And there have been times, you know, that are harder for him where my friends and I just don't know what to do. We can ask him to, you know, take the guns out of his house or to take just the bullets out of the house. But we really don't know what we're supposed to do. And as a researcher, when I was working on this project, I asked people because I wanted the answer, what should I be doing?
Mm-hmm.
There's not really a clear recommendation of when you have someone you care about and you know they own guns and you know they've talked about suicide. Is there anything useful you can do that will lower the risk that they go through with it?
And the answer was not
much. The answer
much,
was no one had anything to tell me, right?
Mm.
But it was something where this idea of, like, could you temporarily bring the guns somewhere else, with their cooperation, or in a more extreme case, without their cooperation? What are their options? Because I never really thought I should go burgle his home, then turn up at the police with just a bunch of guns and go, could you hold on to these for me?
Not the answer. No. One last question here, which is about the language that was in the big spending bill that Congress just passed that now allows, I think if I interpret this right, gun research for the CDC, access now to some of these statistics that the CDC hasn't had. What's your insight on that?
I'm all for the CDC, having the restrictions taken off and be able to research gun deaths and gun policy and gun interventions. But I do think it's much easier to get buy-in for that when people who favor gun control get a lot more precise about what they want to do.
Right.
Stop talking about assault weapons as though they're a real category. Stop talking about silencers as though they make guns like, movie guns where they just go, pshit, pshit, right?
Mm-hmm.
When they're still loud. Silencers don't mean you don't hear a gun go off. And so I think every time a gun control advocate opens their mouth and says something a gun owner hears as just flatly false, said by someone who's never seen a gun in person, we lose credibility for things that do make a difference, like research and other interventions.
This is why you write, I can't endorse policies whose only selling point is that gun owners hate them.
And that was something I didn't like at the marches. I can't speak to the organizers, but there were a lot of signs that were about, like, we're coming for your guns, we're going to stigmatize gun ownership. That's a different goal than saving lives. It's a goal people can have, but they're goals that work at cross purposes if you want the buy-in of people who do own guns responsibly.
Aaliyah, this has been really interesting. I look forward to more conversations with you. I hope we can.
Thanks. I've really had
Thank
a great
you.
Morning.
Aaliyah Libresco is a data journalist, and she's a statistics expert. And she wrote a piece that we've been talking about for The Washington Post.